This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Well, hi everyone, and welcome back to Crosswires. It's James here. As always, we're looking at things in technology that maybe things that don't often get talked about, or cool things in technology. And this week, you know, we've talked about storytelling through video, through music, and through graphic design and games. But this week, I thought we'd take it back and look at the written word. And my guest this week is a perfect guest to talk about this, because we've got a wonderful blend of tech and writing. So would you all please welcome Matt Gemmell. How you doing, Matt?
Hi there, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm amazed that I've got all this set up working. I was saying to Matt pre-show that this is, again, podcasting from a Steam Deck, this time with a little bit better lighting, a little bit better audio, and not quite as rushed to set up. I'm using a 32-inch TV as a monitor, and it's kind of working, you know. If I'll say one thing, I am mind blown by how much you can do on that little Steam Deck.
It's quite a gadget, isn't it? I've got a few friends who've got one. I don't have one myself, but no, it's astonishing what you can make it do. I guess this is good practice for you when you need to cobble together a podcasting setup after the coming apocalypse.
Indeed, yes, absolutely. But the interesting thing is, just as a random aside, we're going to be trying Twitch streaming from this device as well. And in theory, it should possibly outperform my 2017 iMac.
That's pretty amazing. In theory is one of these phrases, though, that must be borne out by experience. But yeah, it's incredible what you can do with compact kit these days.
Oh, gosh. I mean, just look at the iPad. But before we get into some of our actual discussion, Matt, would you like to tell people a little bit about yourself? Because I know there's plenty of opportunities for promotion here, so have at it.
Thank you. So, my name is Matt Gemmell, and I am Scottish, in case that hasn't come across already. My background back in the mists of time was as a software engineer. I did consultant software engineer, worked for a bunch of companies, including Apple. And then about 10 years ago, I decided to have a go at writing before I got any older. So I'm a novelist and have been for quite a while. And that's a wonderful thing to be, because when people out in the real world ask what you do for a living and you say, I'm a novelist, the answer is invariably, you're the first one of those I've ever actually met in person. So I've got a few books out, another one just on the cusp of being finished. I also have a podcast about writing, because there's nothing writers love more than talking about writing instead of actually doing the writing. And I also publish a weekly tiny little short story of sort of 1,000 words or so that goes out for free in all kinds of genres.
Fantastic. Yeah. And we will, of course, make sure we put links to all of Matt's books into the show notes. It's really exciting because I love reading. I'll be honest, you know, with my eyesight, as many of you know, I struggle with traditional paper books. So digital books, like the, you know, things like the Kindle and, you know, even just Apple's iBooks, make such a substantial difference. But from a writing point of view, Matt, what tools do you find are invaluable? I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about your setup for the actual writing of the books? Because I might be wrong. I'm going to assume you might have changed setups, but at one point you were doing everything on your iPad.
In fact, I'm completely an iPad only since I started talking about that, which is the time that you're recalling. I've used the iPad absolutely full time. So I do the entire spectrum, from working up ideas and planning, writing the first draft, editing, and even publishing completely from the iPad now, which is fantastic. My main tool for writing is an app called Ulysses, which is a plain text, as in markdown app. You write in, if your readers aren't familiar with Markdown, your listeners, I imagine many of them are, but it's a plain text format that can be sort of compiled into rich text. And Ulysses is very much aimed at people who are writing long form text, including fiction. So it's got a number of conveniences for that. And it can export not just some ebook formats like EPUB, which is the ubiquitous one, but also press ready, print ready PDF masters to turn into paperbacks. So I'm thankfully now with some of the publisher websites having been updated to more modern technologies and workflows in the last few years, I can do literally the entire process from start to finish completely on an iPad.
Wow. And I'm a big fan of Ulysses. I use Ulysses a lot combined with our Nextcloud instance to write up some of the show notes. I don't know if you noticed, but when I sent over the show notes, that is just a Markdown file that Nextcloud is rendering for us in a handy little collaborative editor.
Yeah, I saw the sort of markup buttons, and it's usually something that's got Markdown behind it these days. It's just such a wonderful format, and there are interpreters, compilers, whatever the correct term is, to turn it into HTML or other rich formats on practically every platform and using every programming language. So it's incredibly portable. And of course, it keeps your valuable work in a plain format that you can take with you for the rest of your life.
Because you're not having to rely on, let's be very honest, has Microsoft introduced a bug into Word that's going to completely break my writing workflow? If, for example, something changed in Ulysses, you're like, oh, I don't like the direction we're heading in. I mean, I'm a big Ulysses fan as well, as I said, but if that changed, then you just take your Markdown files to the next app. You've not lost anything. Everything's still there, and there's no formatting changes, anything like that. It's all just that same Markdown. Now, am I right? Markdown was a John Gruber sort of thing originally?
Yes, John Gruber created Markdown. He wrote the original script that transforms it into HTML in the Perl language, as I recall.
Oh, wow.
And it's caught on. There are various derivatives of it. GitHub's got their own flavor of it that people can use for documents associated with source code projects. And there are lots of extensions to Markdown that provide additional features that the original spec didn't. And these days, you know, if you use any web CMS of any kind, it's pretty much going to support Markdown, as do all the static web blogging software tools. So as you say, if you've got something in Markdown, you know that not only is it a plain text format that you can take wherever, but that it'll be understood and interpreted and rendered just about everywhere you go as well.
And that's really good. I mean, again, be able to export out to PDF and press, not just PDF, but press ready PDF from from Ulysses is fantastic. I guess one question that I was going to ask you about, because obviously with an iPad, if you don't mind me asking, which iPad are you currently sort of rocking for your writing work?
My current iPad, I've had the 12.9-inch iPad Pros for a few generations. It's not that absolutely latest one, which I think was the last year's 2022 with the Apple Pencil Hover thing. It's the previous one, which is the first one that had the mini LED display and the HDR support. So it's that one that I've got at the moment.
Brilliant. And are you finding that that's up for 12.9-inch? Because that's comparable to, say, very comparable to one of the original to a MacBook Air almost, the screen size. Do you find that that's big enough for you to work on?
Yes, because of iOS, or rather iPadOS now, since they obviously branched a few years ago, because there is very much that focus, at least historically, although it's starting to change, on having one app or two apps at the most, having your attention at a time, I find that being in that sort of mindset anyway makes the comparatively limited screen size not a problem, but actually rather an asset. When you're writing, you're not typically looking at multiple apps at the same time. You're either sitting planning something, mind mapping, brainstorming, or you're doing an outline, or you're sitting for hours and days and weeks and months writing away, and it becomes counterproductive to lots of other windows floating about. So even when I was back on Macs full time, I was typically just putting apps into full screen anyway, and indeed all of the writing apps, Ulysses itself, Scrivener is another very popular one. They all have these no distraction, full screen, just get absorbed in the text kind of modes. And iPadOS has always been about that since it sort of was a derivative of iOS to start with. So no, the screen size is absolutely fine for me. The reason I went for the bigger one rather than the 11-inch series of iPad Pros was just because when I'm not writing, when I'm doing planning things for books, I like to use it as a drawing pad sort of thing with notebook apps like GoodNotes and even mind mapping like MindNode. And it's just helpful to have a wee bit of extra room when I'm doing that kind of work.
And I guess because I remember when the iPad originally launched and people saying this, you can't do any real work on an iPad, you can't. But I think that's maybe unfair because it depends on the type of work you're doing. If you are someone who wants to focus on a single task or a single thing. So for example, I edit, as many of you know, I edit all of the audio for this podcast on the iPad using Ferrite. And we actually have an interview with Canis, who's the lead developer of Ferrite soon. But I find it...
That's fantastic. Tell him I'm a big fan of Ferrite because I use that for editing my podcast as well.
Oh, fantastic. So, yeah, isn't it just magical?
Mm.
Apple Pencil to scrub audio? I mean, I get every time I find another Ferrite fan, I get rather excited. I will. Well, we
know it's wonderful. The ripple delete with the pencil when you're drawing from right to left is absolutely fantastic. It was Jason Snell that switched me onto it, and it's a wonderful app.
It is. I know Stephen Robles from the HomeKit and Apple Insider podcast is a big Ferrite user. But again, it just goes to show the iPad is an incredibly powerful tool. In terms of the actual, because you mentioned then about, you know, planning for stories, because I mean, I have never written a novel. I've written blog posts, I've written bits of homework every now and then when I was in school, you know, admittedly probably not as often as I should have done, but you can't just, I guess you can't really just sit down and write a story. You have to spend the time planning. And you were talking about using GoodNotes. Do you find that having that sort of mixed format, be able to do handwritten notes, sketch things out, and then look at those and then work on a story? Do you find the iPad really lends itself to that, especially with the Apple Pencil for those handwritten, you know, sort of planning notes?
It's the primary thing that I love about the iPad, to be honest, the way that it is a... It's not really the machine you see. When you look at a laptop, you kind of see the laptop and you see the screen floating above, and your mental context is the machine. Whereas with the iPad and with an iPhone to some extent as well, your impression of it is just whatever is on the screen at the time because the hardware vanishes. I've been, you know, involved with technology and passionate about technology for long enough that having a device like this thin, pretty light, portable thing that you can draw on and even touch the screen was always one of those specific tech fetishist dreams. And it's such a delight to finally have that. And there really, really is something about pencil and paper or the mechanisms of interacting as if you're using pencil and paper that just, it seems to release something like a muscle you didn't know you had clenched the whole time when you were sitting using a keyboard and interacting indirectly. There is something just subtly psychologically liberating, I find, when you're just interacting with no barrier between yourself and a pencil in your hand. We're also used to it from childhood, at least previously. It's maybe not going to be true of children for too much longer.
No.
But that feels like working directly with something. It feels more like, almost feels more like art itself now than work or thinking or anything that's formal or structured or constrained. And I find that I just make so much more progress when I can sit and draw and scribble and circle things and use a highlighter, albeit digitally. But the thing that makes that practical, of course, is that in apps like GoodNotes and increasingly elsewhere in the system, it can still read the handwriting and provide search results for text that was handwritten and provide a sort of organizational structure. Whereas if you didn't have that, you'd essentially just have the digital equivalent of a whole bunch of sheets of paper and you need to remember where things are, and it sort of becomes a wasted exercise. So the iPad for me is actually the perfect either juxtaposition or combination of the liberty of physical creativity, but still having the convenience of digital searchability and organization. And it's a very powerful thing.
It really is. And I guess at another practical level, as a writer, you're then not dealing with stacks of paper notes. I mean, you know, I always think back to, you know, seeing those stacks of notes and writers, you know, in movies, scrunching up the paper, throwing it in the bin. And then you've got things like, you know, in black books with not maybe writing, but Bernard turning all of his receipts into a fashionable dinner jacket. You know, that dealing with paper. And I mean, look, we've talked about the environmental impact of tech before on this show, but the fact that for the most part, you're not going to be dealing with paper unless we'll talk about what it takes to actually get the stories out there, but until it goes to actual print, I'm going to assume you're not often actually dealing with physical paper anymore.
These days, no, I don't have any encounter with paper until I get in proof copies of the print versions of books. So it's completely digital. I did, of course, print out the entirety of my first novel back then on paper, ostensibly to proofread it and edit it, but really it's just because it's, as you say, it's one of these images of being a writer. There's a certain legitimacy to it, and having that big, massive manuscript stacked up in your desk, it's a little part of what the dream of being a writer is. But of course, it's also a pain in the arse printing the thing out, and you know, if you drop it and have to put it all back in order, and it's an artifact rather than anything that's practical.
I was going to say, that's assuming the printer works in the first place, because you know, printers.
Yeah, they're temperamental. Although I have to say, since I went to a Brother laser printer, I've had absolutely no problem. I've tried to forget the existence of any other type of printer because this thing just works. I'm pretty sure that after nuclear war, I could drag it out the cupboard, and assuming there was electricity, it would just happily print the pages for me without complaint.
Do you know what? At home, I don't have a colour printer. I just have a black and white Brother laser. It does dual-sided, it's networked, and I've had that thing for over 10 years. And apart from occasionally having to change the toner, it works. It works with everything. And, you know, okay.
I think you and I might have the same printer, because my Brother is a black and white laser with dual side as well. So it's like ML2525W or something.
Something like that. Yeah. It's, they are solid. Like, whereas, you know, trying to get my parents, for example, have this behemoth of a former workplace HP printer. And it's like trying to navigate the Enterprise out of space dock to get that thing to print. I don't know. Are you a Star Trek fan?
Massive. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I have to say, I haven't taken in too many of the recent series, but I mean, I was born in 1979, so by the time that Next Generation started in 87, I had seen Star Trek as in the original series on the telly back and forth, but I was kind of there and going into high school, 87 to 94, for Next Generation. So that was very much my Star Trek at the time. Of course, it led straight on to Deep Space Nine and Voyager, which I just devoured as well. So I'm one of these people that up until that point, say, end of Voyager, good chunk of Enterprise, certainly all the movies through, including Generation, First Contact and Insurrection and Nemesis, I'd seen absolutely everything. And I've had the occasional exposure to the newer stuff as well.
The only reason I was asking is when we were talking about, you know, working with the iPad in terms of writing, an instant vision of Jake Sisko in DS9 with all his little pads. And we talked to, because the episode's been recorded, we talked to Gideon Mayhew from the Icon Factory Gideon's such a nice guy. You know, got to give him a bit of support these days, you know, after Elon. But we were talking about how the iPad is very clearly influenced by the pads in Trek. And I think we are at a point where, okay, they're not quite as thin, but certainly you could see a Jake Sisko-like character sat there, you know, doing his novels on an iPad.
Yeah, and especially with dictation having come on so much. I mean, the number of times that I tried to record an equivalent of a captain's log using speech recognition back on the original series of Apple Macintosh computers with a MacinTalk microphone, and the results were just terrible. It's getting better, certainly, with Siri. I tried a huge number of third-party apps for dictating writing as well, like Mac Speech and others whose names I've since forgotten.
Dragon.
Back in the day. Dragon Dictate, of course. That was the one I was struggling for. Thank you. Which provide great results if you train them enough. But the kind of science fiction ideal is that with any accent at all, even my own, you can just talk and it just understands you, including the appropriate punctuation and I guess even idiomatic words and phrases. And we're just getting so close now. I was just the other day when I was recording a podcast episode, someone had sent me a link to, there are so many of these startup companies at the moment who are using GPT to auto-generate various types of texts that are suitable for different types of endeavor, including podcasts. So in the case of a podcast, it'll take your audio file and it'll generate not just a complete transcript, but it will also generate like teaser tweets and, promotional summaries and blog posts, and will suggest titles for the episodes and all that sort of thing. And there are four or five of these companies that do this at least. And the results are pretty good. And if you sort of think about that in terms of the Star Trek computer voice recognition, it's not only taking dictation and producing an accurate transcript, but it's also doing creative things with it and understanding quote unquote some of the context. So we're getting a lot closer to this interesting conversion point where the computers actually do become more like assistants rather than these sort of fairly dumb question and answer machines that they've previously been.
Absolutely. No, I couldn't agree more. And thank you. As a bit, little bit of a tangent, but it just came to me when we were talking about the iPad. And I guess Ben Matt leads us on to, because when we talk about you've spent months, years getting the book ready, getting it to a point where, sorry, not a book, the novel. I'll use the word novel because book sort of seems to refer more to, I guess, more to a printed book, doesn't it, these days? I guess is novel the more appropriate term?
I mean, I love novel because it saves me from answering a second question, because when you tell people that you're a writer, in my experience, the assumption is journalism at first, which I guess is fair and reasonable. So I've just gotten myself into the habit of using the word novelist, not because it's a wee bit arty and pretentious. I know I don't like that side of it, but it just makes it clear right from the front. I guess that books do connote the printed object a bit more, but I see the term interchangeably. I guess everyone's actually so used to ebooks with their Kindles and reading Apple books and iOS devices and the Nooks and the various other types of e-reader that are out there that it's the term has become kind of plastic, and now it just refers to a published work, regardless of whether it's on paper.
That makes a lot of sense. So, and I guess that leads us nicely onto, as a writer, how easy is it for you to now, or where did you have to start out from to get your stories actually published? I mean, obviously, you're not self-publishing. I'm assuming you have a publisher, but what's changed?
No, I am. I'm actually self-pubbed.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, I am. I chose to do that because there's a lot involved in terms of time and waiting and uncertainty and so on with getting published. And in terms of, you can potentially win on the marketing, but that's becoming less and less true. But you lose on the percentages and on the income and on the control. So I am much more of, I like to have control of things. I think this is probably something that is in the DNA of many ex-tech or indeed current tech people, that they like to have visibility into things and like to retain controls and retain options. And the publishing landscape is such that it can be a lottery win to find a publisher, indeed to find representation before that in order to get to a publisher. And with royalty rates, etc., it's often better these days, with everything being so available to you on the internet, distribution, marketing, all of it, If you're capable of doing it yourself and you've got the energy and the time to do it yourself, it's a much faster route to market. I hate to use such a term, but there it is. And it just gives you a lot more control over your own creative product, and you're not signing rights away to anyone via a third party. But publishing these days is, I guess the word would be democratized, wouldn't it? The ebook stuff is dead easy. You already have your ebook from your writing app. You know, Ulysses, Scrivener, Vellum, a whole bunch of other apps on any platform can generate a beautifully formatted and perfectly valid, ready to go ebook. Cover art's another thing. You need to pay for that from someone if you don't want to do it yourself. I'm not a designer, so. And people do very much judge a book by its cover, especially in the ebook thing. You know, ebook stores online and Amazon websites and all that sort of thing. We're just scrolling past loads of little thumbnails. You need to grab people. So I prefer to just, you know, pay for a competent designer. I use Stuart Batch at Books Covered. He's fantastic. But once you've got that, you've got your ebook, you're ready to upload. It's just a matter of filling in a lot of metadata, setting prices, ticking the various boxes for distribution, etc., and away you go. When you've done it before and you're used to it, you can go from not having a book up anywhere, as long as you've got the actual ebook file ready and the cover ready, you can be out there and available to buy on the various Amazon stores around the world, the various Apple stores around the world, etc., within 48 hours quite readily.
Wow.
Paper is a slightly different thing because there are more stringent requirements for the print master PDF file. There's a lot that goes into crop boxes, and you know the pages obviously are running left and right, and there's a lot of typographical convention and so on needed for that. But again, the writing apps take care of quite a lot of it for you. The cover art obviously has different requirements. Typically, they're using a CMYK print process instead of an RGB file. So colors are going to render differently because of different gamuts. I don't know how savvy your listeners might be on that stuff. But it's, you know, it's like anything else in tech. You just, if you want to do it yourself, you just read up about it, learn about it. It's nothing is rocket science if you're willing to spend some time and some neurons on it. You get that stuff ready and there's an approval process for print because you need to actually get a physical copy of it printed so you can see that it's rendering properly. Things aren't being chopped out. The color hasn't run or things haven't disappeared because there's not as much contrast between foreground and background as you think, et cetera, et cetera. So there's more lead time involved with that and more costs because you're always paying for books to be printed and bound and sent to you. But the main thing that you need there is distribution. And even if it's print on demand, which is the model these days whereby a customer places an order and then a book is printed in response to that and shipped out to them, so it's a just-in-time kind of thing. Even with that, you obviously need your book's data to be available, so it needs to be pushed into the Amazon catalog, pushed into the Apple catalog, ideally pushed into all of the booksellers, so I guess Barnes & Noble, etc. in the United States, Waterstones, etc. here in the UK. The independent bookstores, public libraries as well, who can order books for you. Hopefully, your listeners know that. If there's a book you want, you can go to your library, you can order it. It's wonderful for you because you get a book for free. It's great for your library because they get used and they're engaged and they get new books. And it's actually great for authors as well because we get a better royalty when copies go to libraries than via bookstores, believe it or not, even though it's more affordable for the library as well. So yeah, there's a fair bit involved and there's a lot of moving parts, but it's like anything else. The first time's the worst time, and after that you just get a wee routine and a wee checklist going. And each new launch gets faster and faster in terms of the technicalities and the administrative side. And you can focus more on the promotion and the marketing and the social media and so on.
And with that print on demand model, does that mean that effectively, if I were to take a trip into the town centre and go into Waterstones, am I going to randomly find Matt Gemmell books on the shelf?
On average, no, but sometimes. What you certainly will find is if you go in and go to the counter and say, can you get me? It'll be on the computer.
Right.
Because the industry standard data feeds are there and they can obtain it quickly.
Is that all based on the ISBN system?
Yeah, printed materials all require an ISBN, and it's got to be a unique ISBN for each different edition, even of the same work. So if you get a paperback, you get a hardback, you get an ebook, that's going to be three ISBNs. Although in practice, ebooks, some of the ebook sellers don't require an ISBN, but certainly for the printed versions, that's the kind of master code. And ISBNs also must be purchased because there's only certain companies in each country, different one for the UK, for France, for the United States, and so on, that can sell these ISBNs. So it costs, and they cost a fair bit of money. They're expensive, but it is a necessary cost of doing business if you're going to produce printed materials. And of course, there is also the deposit libraries aspect of things, where by law in each country, and you need to check with your own country, you might be required to lodge a copy of every printed publication you produce with them, so that they've got, you know, got it on record. So the British Library, I think the Bodleian in Oxford, I think Trinity, the Dublin campus has got one of these. National Library of Scotland, I think, as well. But you can find these things online, and you send them a copy, and they, you know, 3 years later send you a lovely headed notepaper letter saying, you know, thanks, we got it. We'll put it in a vault underground somewhere forever.
Yeah, because a good friend of mine who's actually studying at Oxford, he's doing his PhD in comp sci. And another friend of ours is a massive book nerd and keeps trying to get this other friend to let him into the Bodleian Library with his student ID. And my friend's like, no, I can't let you in. They would kill, it's really tightly controlled, apparently. But, and that's a really good point, by the way. Do support your local library if you love to read. You know, unfortunately, independent bookshops and, you know, and as much as Amazon and Barnes & Noble online are wonderful places to get things in, certainly from a digital book point of view, your independent booksellers, go and support them. I think, is that a fair, I mean, I don't, you might disagree as an author, but I doubt you will, but I'm putting myself in a difficult situation here, but like support independent booksellers and your local libraries. As Matt said, he gets more money if you order a book through the library. That's always a good thing. And it means that the libraries stay open because we're far more than just a collection of books.
Gosh, yes. You're finding people who are passionate about, providing information and entertainment to people. And there's something, at least still for you and I, there's a certain coziness and a certain nostalgia and a certain comfort to not just libraries, but the very similar atmosphere in independent bookshops. There's the closeness of the shelves, the smell of the paper, that's more on the bookshop side. And there's that sort of, that wonderful, reassuring sort of institutional quality to public libraries. There's nothing like, as an author, there's nothing quite like seeing your book in a local library in your own city, your own town. You know, there's something just, There's a wee element of that, I have made it. I have got a little piece of the dream that I was hoping for. Also, on a practical matter, for goodness sake, help yourself, help your library, and help your bookshop by putting your genre on the back cover of your books. Don't make them guess or read the blurb or whatever, because you can get some interesting mistakes made. Tell them where it should be shelved, and librarians will thank you.
Yes, help the poor librarians. They do a great, I mean, I couldn't do that. I could not organize books like that. I mean, my own bookshelves at home are, well, bookshelf. So I love local libraries. I have to admit, I haven't been to mine for a while, but that's not through not wanting to. It's just, well, I live in Boscombe Library. We'll leave it at that, folks. Anyway, so. Let's move on a little bit to another very important tool of writing. And that has to be, you know, if you're not using the pen to do your notes, you're going to be using the keyboard. Now, I know you from what sort of talking to you on, and obviously seeing some of your I was going to say tweets, but toots now. I know you have a bit of a thing for a mechanical keyboard. What is it that is so important about getting that good keyboard? Why can you not use like the £5 Poundland keyboard?
Well, I think that's one of these questions that one's spouse perhaps asks one when the latest mechanical keyboard arrives. I mean, of course you could, and we all go through life using, whatever random keyboard is included with the computer you're compelled to use at the time. You've got to choose your drugs, basically, don't you? There are some things that you want to just spend money on and dive deep into and feel that you're an enthusiast about something. And this one, it's got so much to offer me because, one, it's tech, it's related to computers, it's electronics, it's to do with writing, and it has this wonderful, this physicality, this tactility, this percussiveness, and endless tweaking, and it overlaps massively with electronics and soldering, or soldering for your American listeners, of course, and wires and gadgets and gizmos and multimeters and all that stuff. But also, there's an artistic element to it, with customizing the keycaps and the RGB underlighting and all that nonsense. So it's one of these things that you can go far down the rabbit hole, I suppose you would say. And I've got I wouldn't even like to say, in case my wife does listen to this episode, just how many of them I've got, but I've got a few different mechanical keyboards in the cupboard, and I do genuinely rotate through them every few weeks or so. Because, hey, if nothing else, it's yet another way to procrastinate.
Indeed. I mean, look, I'm not sure if this qualifies. I'm using one of those gaming mechanical keyboards. It is a Logitech. It's, what is it? It's a TK413, I think. And it has that percussive, it has that nice feel. But I know that I eventually want to upgrade. I don't understand anything about, I'll be honest, I don't really understand the difference between the switches, because from a trying to keep it as simple as we can, what's the difference between, say, for example, then how maybe we talk about mechanical, but what makes a keyboard mechanical? What's the difference between, say, let's take, for example, Apple's, what if we call it Magic Keyboard, these days, the Magic Keyboard, what makes a mechanical keyboard so substantially different in feel and mechanics, I guess, to that sort of keyboard?
Yeah, well, the commonly kind of accepted definition, I think, with a mechanical keyboard is that it's simple. It's just that the entirety of the switch mechanism for each key is a separate little unit. That's on the technical side. If you've got your Apple Magic Keyboard, or the keyboard that plugs into the iPads or whatever, which I guess is also called a Magic Keyboard.
It is, yeah.
Then you've got, each key's obviously got a separate a keycap thing on the top, and it's got some sort of hinge or scissor mechanism or whatever underneath. But beneath that, there's just one big board with all the actual contact sensors and electronics, and it's all one big bit. Whereas on a mechanical keyboard, what you'll find is if you pop off the key cap that's got the letter or the number on it or whatever, and you see the little bit that is going up and down, that's a separate component. So the post that sticks up the top that keycap connects to, the sort of receiver that it goes into, the spring, whatever else might be in it, and the electronics to make the connection, it's a separate little unit. And you can, the big attraction with most mechanical keyboards is that you can pop out those switches, the thing that, actually provides the contact when you press the keycap down, for different ones that have different feels. And they broadly fall into three categories. There's the linear type, which is common in gaming keyboards because you can easily press them super fast, which can be an advantage in games, that just basically goes straight up and down. It's like pressing a spring. It's nice and smooth, straight up and down, no particular bump in the middle, no noise. It's literally pressing down on a spring or a sponge or something like that. And it's called linear. Advantages, as I say, they're fast and they're very quiet, generally speaking. The second category is tactile. And they have a noticeable sort of bump either halfway down or a quarter of the way down or two-thirds of the way down or whatever. You will feel just this mechanism engaging, but without much of an appreciable noise. And typists kind of like that because you're getting feedback all the time, physical feedback through your fingertips. You know exactly when you've pressed the keys. You can get a nice rhythm going, a flow. And the third category, which is really just a close cousin of the tactile type, is clicky. And as the name implies, it doesn't just have that tactile bump. It also makes a noise, a snicky, 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 snicky noise, much closer to the typewriters of old. Not the kind of thing you would probably want to use if you're in the office or, you know, you've got a sleeping child right through a thin wall or something like that. But there are loads of variants of these, varying not just the broad type, but how there are different categories switch in terms of how tall they are, how far your fingers have to go, how much force is required to actuate them, etc., 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 etc. Just like any hobby, particularly ones on the technical side, you can pretty much go as deep as you want to go. I think it's just about customization. You know, we do the same things to our computers with stickers on the back. We do the same things to our cars. We redecorate our home offices. It's another one of those things. You decide to spend the time and the energy on getting something that you feel is personal to you and reflects effort and the sort of an aesthetic and all these sort of things. And I think it just it's like any other hobby in that regard.
Absolutely. And I know from speaking to and seeing, you know, people doing keyboard streams, I think, is it Stephen Hackett who does a keyboard building stream every now and then? Seeing the passion people putting to build, look, I've never built a mechanical keyboard and I probably never will. I don't know. Maybe, but I know they can get, again, if Mrs. Gemmell's listening, you just close your ears for this bit. They can get very expensive.
Oh yeah, wildly expensive. The thing that surprises a lot of people when they find out about the whole mechanical keyboards hobby is that typically you're not buying things in the way that you're used to buying things. When you want to buy something like almost anything, you go online, you place an order and it arrives in a few days, but it's not like that. With mechanical keyboards are pretty much all of the purchasing is based on these things called group buys, which you might have encountered, whereby a certain number of people have to sign up and commit to buying the thing before the orders are even placed. So it's kind of like Kickstarter, but it's pretty much always like that. And the lead times are months, if not years away. And that is absolutely the normal, everyday, most common scenario by far. And that's not just for entire keyboards. That's also routinely for sets of key caps, just the actual printed key surfaces that plug on. There are loads of different sets, different, as you can imagine, typefaces and materials and colors, etc., that are manufactured all the time. But you almost always have to wait a year, 2 years, or whatever for them to arrive. And they're massively expensive. You can readily, for a complete set of nice quality keycaps with all of the extras that will suit any size of keyboard you might put them on in the future, be spending hundreds of US dollars, pounds, euros, and waiting months or years to get them. So it's at its deeper levels, it's a bit of a nutter's kind of hobby, to be honest. But, you know, equally, you're getting something that is relatively unique and you won't find it probably on anyone else's desk. And there's a sense of ownership and investment and so on and so forth. And of course, there's a little economy built into it with resale of and how much keycaps hold their value and all the madness of it, if you want to go that far. Personally, I just like having a typing machine that I've customized to the feel that I like, that makes me feel like a writer and that feels like it's mine in the same way that, you know, you buy a nice car that you've wanted or you get a nice desk chair or something like that.
And maybe a good question, because I'm, you know, obviously you can buy pre-made mechanical keyboards, you know, with Logitech. I guess, is it fair to say you kind of have to watch out for maybe things that aren't quite as well built in the lower price. I mean, when we talk for a good mechanical keyboard, what would you say is a at this point, you know, you're probably getting something decent price point?
You know, it varies enormously. As with so many things, if you're willing to build yourself, then you can get the individual components pretty cheaply. The major cost of a mechanical keyboard is not the PCB, the printed circuit board thing in the middle of it, not at all. And each of the individual key switches, even though you need dozens and dozens of them, the actual unit price is very cheap. You can get, you know, 100 odd key switches for, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 quid, whatever it is. The keycap sets tend to be expensive, and all of the other stuff that goes in. Actually, when you're buying a nice mechanical keyboard, very often the biggest cost by far is the casing of it, the physical casing, because they're very often made of nice pieces of aluminium, and it's made out of a single bit, and it's all nicely polished or whatever. And then there's a metal plate inside that's got all the holes in it for where the key switches go in, because you don't usually plug key switches directly into the circuit board beneath. Often they go through a metal or polycarbonate plate or something. So a lot of wee bits, and there's the feet, and there's maybe foam inside to dampen sound and cushion components, blah, 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 blah. So because of all of that, it's pretty common to buy kits, which gives you an entire keyboard, albeit you have to assemble it yourself when it arrives, and that's the hundreds of pounds. If you're just looking to get started with a nice sort of tactile mechanical keyboard, I think you could readily get something really nice and usable from the slightly more budgety brands and still be under 100 quid today. So there's Ducky, like Ducky, like the animal, is a brand. And if you're looking to go up slightly into a brand that's really popular in the Mac or Apple world and has huge variation on offer, there's a company called Keychron, so Keychron. Logitech's very well thought of as well. I think they've got a bunch of mechanical offerings, as well as, of course, their more Apple-style membrane all-in-one portable Bluetoothy keyboards. And there's just lots you can do. I'm not someone who says, you know, it's not worth it if you're not spending more than £100. God, no. If you want to try a mechanical keyboard, start by getting something at 30 or 40 quid off of Amazon and see if you like the feel and the noise. The main attraction of it is that you can probably replace the bits of it you don't like so much without throwing the whole thing away, because it's decomposable, you know?
Oh, that makes sense. Because, look, you've already kind of answered one of the questions I was going to ask you. One of the problems when you look at, not problems, when you look at pre-made keyboards, most of them tend to be very PC-focused, so they'll have the PC keyboard layout. Mm. But Keychron do seem to do some very nice Mac layouts, and I will admit I am probably looking at one of it. It's about just under £100. We'll put a link in the show notes, and it's the one. I haven't decided if I want to go 10 keyless or not. I mean, it's a tricky one. I mean, this whole week I'll be using this Logitech without a numpad, so we'll see how that goes for work, because I have to enter a few numbers at work. But they look really nice, and they have swappable keycaps so that you can use them on PC or on Mac. And I think out of the box, they come ready for Mac. And yeah, I mean, they sounds like they're a good choice, Ben Keychron's. I think I've forgotten which one it is off the top of my head, but it's just under 100.
They've got a big range. Yeah. Well, the nice thing with mechanical keyboards is that once you get out of the very entry-level range, virtually all of them have customizable firmware, so you can remap all the keys anyway, you know. So getting a PC-looking keyboard to be suitable for macOS or iOS is a matter of, you know, popping off a couple of keys so you can replace, you know, the Windows key with a command key if you like that, and switching the sort of assigned function of that key.
Yes.
Using software, which then sort of sends it down onto your keyboard and records it on the keyboard. And then from then on, it just does that. And that's all that your Keychrons are doing. When you flip the switch on the side to go from PC to Mac, they're just choosing a new key map, basically. And virtually every mechanical keyboard lets you do that. And indeed, much more comprehensively. You can extensively change what all the keys do. And since you can swap the keycaps around, you can, you know, literally move your keycaps around to suit your new configuration. On the subject of the numpad there, I've never been able to use the number row across the top of the keyboard very accurately without looking at it. I mean, I'm a 10-finger touch typist, I think, very rapidly, but I always make mistakes with number row because from keyboard to keyboard, it tends to drift around a bit, and it's just a bit arbitrary, whereas I'm so used to that numpad layout or a desk calculator that on many of my mechanical keyboards, almost none of which have a physical numpad, I can just press a combination of keys to toggle it into a mode whereby there is a numpad laid out across the keys in that same 7, 8, 9, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 0 layout. So I can use it the way my muscle memory expects, but without needing to have a physical separate set of keys. And that's one of the big benefits of mechanical keyboards, in that you can have as many layers of functionality as you like.
Oh, so you can use like a function key or a key combination to go into the next layer.
Exactly, like the same way a caps lock key suddenly turns all the alphabetical keys into uppercase versions of themselves, or the same way that holding the shift key turns the numbers into exclamation and at symbol and so on. You can do that as much as you like and for anything. So the keyboard I've got in front of me, myself right now, which is a plank, it's ortholinear, so it's completely a grid. It's not, the rows aren't staggered at all, and it's just four rows of 12 keys. So no room for function keys or number keys or a numpad or separate cursor block or page up, page down or anything. But I've got all of those functions in that keyboard via combinations. I've got a numpad, I've got a mouse in there, cursor keys, lighting control. I've also got a number row. I've got a whole bunch of extra symbols on dedicated keys that I don't even have on a full-size regular keyboard because I've customized it. So if you're the kind of person who, and this is common in tech, that likes to customize their setup and their wallpaper and their shell scripts and, you know, tweak their app themes and color schemes and all that sort of thing, you're a tweaker and a customizer and a personalizer, which I think is very, very common in tech people, then mechanical keyboards could be quite dangerously attractive to you for that reason.
I should probably ask at this time, how many hours have you wasted? Let me rephrase that. How many hours have you spent fiddling with a mechanical keyboard when maybe you should have been working on a chapter of a novel?
I would have to say all of the hours that I've spent fiddling with mechanical keyboards. And the verb would definitely be wasted rather than spent. But I guess it depends how you assign value to time, you know? If you get enjoyment out of not just the outcome, but the process and the feeling of empowerment and the fact that you're exercising your mind, I guess, in order to optimize something for yourself, and I'm someone who very much does derive enjoyment from that, then it can't be time wasted, really, can it?
No, not at all. Matt, speaking of time, I'm very conscious that we both probably have things to do today, but this has been such a great discussion. One thing I wanted to sort of ask you before we wrapped up is, if one of our listeners is maybe considering, I want to start writing full time, I want to start actually telling stories or, you know, writing a book, what would you say, as someone who's been through this and spent, the last 10 years doing this, what would be your biggest piece of advice for them?
Well, the first thing I would say would be encouragement. It's never been so accessible as it is today. There are no barriers. As long as you're online, you can readily get software to help you. You can readily get the advice. You can readily publish, not just digitally, but in print, and you can absolutely do it all. There are a huge number of extremely helpful guides, books, websites, podcasts, all of that sort of thing. The main advice, though, that I would give you is the only thing that can truly get in your way and stop you writing is yourself. So set aside some time, put aside the hesitation, the embarrassment, sit down and just commit to writing something, no matter how silly. The beautiful thing about writing is that the more you write, the more inspired you get, the easier it gets, and there's always editing to fix it later. I was hugely passionate about writing as a teenager, and then I put it aside for more sensible and financially responsible things, did university, comp sci degree, worked and so on and so forth. But the love of that form of creativity with written word never went away. And when I came back to it, it was like, it wasn't just like coming home, it was like getting younger again. If you have the urge to do it, then you have the capability to do it. Because speaking as a father of a 2.5-year-old son, creativity is an absolutely natural, built-in, pre-existing human faculty. It's not something you need to worry about or worry about not having. Everyone has got any number of stories to tell. So sit down and get started.
Awesome. I love that advice. And Matt, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a genuine pleasure. Where can people find more about you? And obviously make sure they, and also the books, where can people find everything?
I am online at mattgemmel.scott. That's mattgemmel.scott, S-C-O-T, of course. And you can find all of my books there, my podcast, my blog, and jumping off points to my social media accounts everywhere. I'd absolutely love to hear from you.
Fantastic. And folks, please do, yeah, tell, let us know, you know, do you have any stories about, you know, writing, or do you have your, like, oh my gosh, I spent four years building a mechanical keyboard. Drop those over to podcast@crosswires.net, or come and join me Discord. Come and we'll be putting this up as a discussion thread. Come and join us. Just listen to the outro for the links. Matt, thank you again for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much, James. The pleasure has assuredly been mine.
Let's roll that outro. Thanks for listening to this episode of Cross Wires. We hope you've enjoyed our discussion, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. So please drop us a note over to podcast@crosswires.net.
You can also drop us a comment on the post, or if you're a good pod user, why not start a discussion there too?
You can also join our new Discord server at crosswires.net/Discord. We've got forum channels for each episode, and we'd love you to join the discussion there.
You can also follow us on Mastodon at crosswires@mastodon.social.
And of course, you can find the show in all the good podcast apps, and all the really bad ones too.
More of our content, head on over to crosswires.net/YouTube for all our videos, and keep an eye on our Twitch channel at crosswires.net/live. Our upcoming streams.
If you like what you heard, please do drop a review in your podcast directory of choice. It really does help spread the word about the show.
And of course, if you can spare even the smallest amount of financial support, we'd be incredibly grateful. And you can support us at ko-fi.com/crosswires. That is ko-fi.com/crosswires.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.